asking ourselves if it's not because he's an American citizen that no charges has been pressed against him when he's been sectioned for drug trafficking and money laundering in the States, and he's still living in the States. That does not happen very often. I don't think there's any other case where the United States is sectioning someone for drug trafficking and money laundering on US soil, and that person does not end up in prison.
Yeah, and then because I mean, and that's something that we have to unpack a bit further, because even when we're talking about the guns, they're not being made in Haiti, and
Exactly.
they're coming in from somewhere, particularly I think some people have said it from Miami and that other areas,
From
but
Miami,
Miami,
particularly
yeah.
from Florida and Georgia, that's where the most of the guns are coming from. There was a UN report that was published, and in that UN report from UNODC, it clearly says that the guns are coming from Florida and Georgia to Haiti. But yet we have not seen any action from US government or from the Biden administration to prevent that from happening.
And sadly, this really is the continuation since Haiti fought for freedom in the 1700s,
Yes.
1800s. This is a
Yes.
continuation. Yeah, sorry, if
Haiti
you go
is
ahead.
being Haiti is being punished for ending slavery and changing the state of the world. Because when Haiti ended slavery, when Haiti become an independent country, the first Black Republic, the entire economic order of the world changed as well. Capitalism had to change because the economy was on men exploiting men, free labor. That's how all of those Western hemisphere country became rich. It was not from their hard work. It was from the hard work of Black people. It was from slavery, from exploiting human beings. So when Haiti dared to end slavery, to win the war against the French army, we paid that very, very high. We paid a very high price for that, not only financially with the billions of dollars that are now owed from France, that France owes to Haiti, but also from the fact that they prevented us by any means of achieving peace or even living decently. Haiti is still paying for the fact that we are the first Black Republic. We are the first nation to end slavery.
And then now it comes to control the country. It comes in the form of the gangs to make it to destabilize the political economic
Yeah, the
system. And yeah,
yes,
sorry.
from when the from when the from when the Marines came to Haiti in 1915, they never left. And the reason why they came to Haiti in 1915 was because they wanted to make sure that this Black country never do well, because it is their way of saying to the world that look at those Black people, they cannot do anything good.
You're listening to a recent conversation with activist Velena Elise Chalier, who's a member of Non-Pas-Dormir, which means we aren't sleeping, and is based in Port-au-Prince. In the conversation, she contextualizes the current political and security situation in Haiti. The music in the background is Sika Zedu by Oluva Mtukudzi, and we play that remembering Oluva Mtukudzi's birthday, which is September 22nd. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation. And as you said, the Marines never left, and now that connects to, because as people see the gangs and then they see UN intervention force, they don't really understand that this is really the continuation of that policy of, you know, the Marines in the early 1900s, 1915, that's when they came in. And of course, even before that, in the 1800s, when Haiti was, there was a Navy blockade on the island by by the former colonizers, France and United States and other places and other countries. So this is just really when one unpacks that policy, it's not an accident. As I always use this phrase, the Ghanaian phrase is accident according to plan.
Yes.
And so now you have the situation where you have instead of the Marines, you have the use of the UN international system, which has come in periodically in Haiti. And if you could especially unpack the current situation, because we now have Kenyan police force coming in and a number of other countries. If you could talk to us about that.
It's another way. Yeah, I can talk about that. It's another way for the U.S. to control the situation in Haiti. And it's a lot of hypocrisy, you see. What they are doing is, because there's a lot of backlash in the world against U.N. intervention in Haiti, they decided that they were doing something new, and that something new became the Kenyan police, who we have to remind people is one of the most violent and most corrupt police of the world. They invested a lot of money in that Kenyan police, money that could have been invested in the Haitian police and the Haitian army, but because they do not want Haiti to be self-sufficient, and because they don't want Haiti to have its own sovereignty, that sort of money is never invested in Haiti. It's always invested elsewhere. Now it's invested in the Kenyan police and all of the other forces that are sending 30 soldiers, 200 soldiers, 400 soldiers, or police officers. And all of it is funded by the U.S. at more than 70%. That basket fund that the U.N. is looking for to finance the current mission, we have to understand that close to 60%, if not 70% of it, is financed by the U.S. And whoever is financing and is in reality the one who is giving order, because they have the money, so they decide. And Kenya, it's a very good commercial transaction for them, because all of the equipment is going to be for them. They can come into Haiti, they decide for Haiti, they have meetings with diplomats without the government being present. It really is a state in a state. It's the business of international aid. A lot of powerful people working in the humanitarian sector are making a lot of money out of the crisis that is ongoing in Haiti and many other countries around the world where there is a conflict, created conflict in the lobby aisle in Washington, you see? And it's a different way for the U.S. of controlling the situation while saying it's not us on the ground, it's the Kenyan. That's what we're saying. And it's very important to remind people that a lot of money, a lot of equipment, a lot of training is being given to the Kenyan police. And the Haitian police or the Haitian army does not get a similar treatment. While we all know that no country in the world can survive by outsourcing its security, security has to come from within. You can have cooperation with countries. I'm not there saying that we do not need the international community or we do not need cooperation. That's not what I'm saying at all. We need cooperation. We need the help, but the help has to be beneficial for Haiti. It has to be in the best interest of Haiti. Why aren't we seeing $200 million being invested into our army or our police? Why is that money invested elsewhere to buy security for Haiti? You're only going to buy it for a couple of years, and then after that, we're going to go back to the same crap, or even worse. It's to believe the situation is worse because they are not investing in sustainability. They're not investing in a long-lasting sustainable solution for the security of Haiti. You can never mention the Haitian army because they don't want Haiti to have an army. While we all know that the situation that we are living in Haiti now, the level of organized crime, the heavy weapons that we are seeing, they are war weapons. The gangs are almost like military organization. It would ask for a military answer to that. But we're not seeing the investment into our army so that the army can respond to the violence that the gang are doing against us. There's all kind of excuse for us not to bring the army back. Of course, the army that we had during the Papadopoulos years and during the Babydopoulos, during the dictatorship, it was a very violent and human rights predator army. But that does not mean that a country like Haiti, in the bad security situation that we are, can go for very long without an army. But this is not the conversation that we are seeing happening. What we are seeing happening is investing even more money into a foreign force, while here in the country, we do not have a solution that's going to be sustainable. And they never listen to us Haitians.
And again, that's Belena Elise Chalier. She's a member of Nonpop Domi, which is organization in Haiti. The meaning of the organization is We Aren't Sleeping, and she's talking to us directly from Port-au-Prince. And as you were talking about the force and also the Kenyan force, the Kenyan police force, which has been there since June, what has there been role in the security? How have the gangs seen them? Has there been any have they been able to provide any meaningful security, or just basically what is their relationship but how do the gangs see them?
Well, honestly, nothing is happening. I live in Port-au-Prince. I have been living in Haiti for as long as I can remember. I have been living in Port-au-Prince because I'm originally from Gonaïves, which is in the north side of the country. I'm living in Port-au-Prince since 2004. So it's been 20 years now. I've never left Haiti. This is where I'm living. I came back after university and here I am still working. I have 4 kids in Haiti. My husband is in Haiti. I'm not seeing any light at the end of the tunnel. I'm not seeing more security. I'm not seeing the Kenyans engaging into operations along with the Haitian police against the gangs. I cannot go downtown. So despite all of the lies that I'm reading into Kenyan newspapers, the truth is that nothing is happening. The gangs are as powerful as they were, if not even more powerful. When there was talk about an international intervention, the gangs seemed, you know, somewhat nervous. You would see them on social media posting videos about how they're getting ready to fight against the Kenyans, to fight against the Haitian police, and then nothing happened. So they are even more powerful. Nowadays, even ports are closing in Haiti because you have gangs going on boats, kidnapping people on boats, kidnapping Filipinos on boats. So it is that bad. At one point when the roads were no longer safe, people started taking boats to travel from one city to another, or taking the plane to travel from one city to another. Now, even the sea is no longer safe because we have pirates. The gangs have pirates in the sea. So we are yet to see any real, meaningful, powerful action from the Kenyan police that came to support Haiti. Maybe they're still planning. I'm not a security expert, so I cannot say what they they are brewing, but whatever they're cooking is not cooked yet. And we are still in a city that's controlled by the gangs at more than 80%.
And then recently, the Kenyan president was in Haiti, actually on September 21st. Where did he go? Did he see the Haitian community at all, apart from just the officials?
No, he saw the officials. He saw the officials. That's what all he did. He saw the officials. He gave his speech. He did his meetings. And then he went straight to Washington to negotiate more money. That's it. That's all.
So this was just, this is basically, as we saw from afar, just a photo op event.
Exactly. That's it. That's all. Even when you have the current prime minister going to the general hospital, or even when you have the current prime minister pretending that he's walking downtown by the general hospital, it's just for show. Us, the everyday men and women, we cannot go to the general hospital. We cannot go to the Champ de Mars. We cannot go downtown Port-au-Prince. So nothing has been done. It's all a lie. But it's good for them to lie because they need more money. They're corrupt and they need more money for their pockets. And the Kenyan president needs more money for the elites in Kenya.
Yeah, and as you're talking about these peacekeeping forces and the amount of money that these countries get, there's been reports that I saw. I can't remember which newspaper, but they were talking about the recent discussion by this U.S. Secretary of State who was in Haiti in early September, and it seems like they're floating an idea of another UN peacekeeping force. I don't know if you've heard anything.
Well, we heard that as well. We heard that as well. We know that on the UN front, the general secretary of the UN is really against another mission. There are other countries like Russia or China that are really against other mission. But if there is one thing that we know in Haiti is that whatever the states wants to happen in Haiti happens in Haiti. Whatever the U.S. decides to happen in Haiti happens in Haiti. And it seems more and more as if they are pushing for a different type of mission from what we have now. Maybe they're going to be brewing another recipe and then give it another name to try and hide what they are doing in reality. But we can see that they want to do a different mission. And myself, I'm looking at it and I'm very worried because, like I was saying earlier, I'm not seeing any sustainable solution for the security of Haiti. I'm not seeing investment being made in our army or in our police so that we no longer have to count on other people to come and secure our country and our population. All I am seeing is the same control machine that we've been having for a century now into Haitian politics.
And before we go, I don't know, what would you like for ordinary citizens here in the U.S. to be in solidarity with people in Haiti, the actual people? I'm not talking about the officials, but people like yourself and others. How can we be supportive of the people and solidarity?
Well, I mean, first thing first, I cannot finish the talk with you without addressing how the Haitian community in the States has been historically, but particularly recently, victim of racism.
Yes, that's very important.
It's very important to mention that not only racism, but clearly hate speech. We have already seen very dark years in the United States for Black people. So when hate speech and when congressmen person who wants to become president is very freely talking about racism and pointing out a certain group of people and directing their hate and the racism toward that group of people, every immigrant and every Black person or person of color in the United States of America needs to be alert and engaged against what's happening. Because it's not very long that there was still segregation in the States. Haiti was independent for very long before they ended slavery in the States. So anybody who wants and who believe in freedom and who believe in love and who believe that every human being is a human being, which is what Dessalines, the founder of our country, was saying in his first constitution, that every human being is a human being. Anybody who believes in that talk needs to be very alert towards the hate speech, the violence, and the racism that's directed towards Haitians and towards immigrants in the States. So I think that the first thing that anybody who's listening to me can be doing is organizing, engaging, and being very active in their community against hate and against violence towards all and every ethnic group. Because once that violence starts, it's not going to end. And even the white person who may think that because they are white, they are safe from that hate and that violence, well, they need to remember what those white countries did to the white people in their own country. They can go and read about history, about what England did to the Irish people. So anybody who wants to see peace, whenever somebody is talking and freely directing hate speech towards people, you have to be very alert and you have to actively be fighting against it. So if I was to ask anybody today to do anything, it would be that. Be alert and engage yourself, because peace is only achieved when all of us believe that peace is the way. But when you turn a blind eye towards what's happening to your neighbor, it's going to happen to you. That's what's happening in Haiti. And I think that's what anybody in the States should be mindful of and being engaged in the fight for freedom and for love and for peace.
Belena, thank you very much for taking the time out of your busy schedule, and also out of in this particular time as you face all these challenges, to be with us, to explain to us, to contextualize the situation on the ground in Haiti.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
You've just been listening to a recent conversation with activist Velena Elize Chalier, who was contextualizing the current political and security situation in Haiti. Velena Elize Chalier is an activist and a member of Non-Pap Domi, which means We Aren't Sleeping, and is based in Port-au-Prince. The music in the background is Sparks by Haitian All Jazz Stars. That's it for Africa Now for today. I'm your host, Moise Mtali. Up next is Headline News, followed by Sha'anan and Hussein Alamin, which looks at issues in Northern Africa and the Middle East with a special spotlight on the plight of Palestinians. And that's followed by the women's collective Sophie's Parlor, which is followed by Human Rights and Justice with Nkechi Taifa. And that's followed by Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly, which is followed by Combit Lakai with Eugenia Charles, which looks at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on X, formerly Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online on X. That's Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to African Isles executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineers, Michael Nicella and Leah Chapman. And thanks to our research fellow volunteers, Chanda Kozer and Funangonda, and our Africa World Now Project collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Utterson. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW and to you for joining us. Continue to support all the great programs on WPFW, particularly later this October when we have our fall pledge drive. We're going to leave you the closing song entitled Someday We'll All Be Free by Donny Hathaway, as we remember Donny Hathaway's birthday, which is October 1st. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week. And stay safe.
WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York. I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. Vice presidential candidates J.D. Vance and Tim Walz faced off last night in their first and only debate of the 2024 campaign. The event was widely noted for its civility and focus on policy, as the two candidates differed on a range of issues, from abortion to immigration to healthcare and democracy. Senator Vance defended Donald Trump's position that abortion regulation should be left up to the states. Governor Walz disagreed, saying abortion is a basic human right. On immigration, Vance blamed Kamala Harris for the number of migrants who have crossed the border under the Biden administration, while Walz called for immigration reform and criticized Trump for blocking bipartisan solutions. On the issue of democracy, Vance was pressed on his past comments that he wouldn't have certified the results of the 2020 election and refused to explicitly back down.
This was a threat to our democracy in a way that we had not seen. And it manifested itself because of Donald Trump's inability to say. He is still saying he didn't lose the election. I would just ask that. Did he lose the 2020 election?
Tim, I'm focused on the future. Did Kamala Harris censor Americans from speaking their mind in the wake of the 2020 COVID situation?
That is a damning non-answer.
It's a damning non-answer for you to not talk about censorship.
When asked if they would support or oppose a preemptive strike on Iran by Israel, both candidates cited Israel's right to defend itself without directly answering the question. Yesterday, Iran launched at least 180 ballistic missiles at Israel in what it said was an act of self-defense against Israel's aggressive actions. Israel promised a painful retaliation, which could include attacks on Iranian oil production, according to Axios. The UN reported one death, a Palestinian in the occupied West Bank, from the missile attack, which came hours after Israel launched a limited ground invasion of southern Lebanon. A Pentagon statement said most missiles were intercepted, with assistance from U.S. ships based in the region. Just before the missile attack, a shooting attack in Tel Aviv killed 7 people and wounded another 16. Fighting between Israel and the Iran-backed Hezbollah group continued in southern Lebanon today, according to statements from both sides. Israel reported 8 soldiers killed in combat and said it will send additional infantry and armored units into the fight. Separately, an Israeli air and ground attack launched earlier today in the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis has killed at least 51 people and injured another 82. The UN Security Council is meeting today in an emergency session called by Israel and France. U.S. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield called for the Security Council to, quote, speak out in one voice and condemn Iran for its unprovoked attack, and called for the imposition of, quote, serious consequences on Iran's military. Iranian Ambassador Amir Saeed called the missile barrage a, quote, proportionate response to Israel's continued terrorist aggressive acts. France's ambassador condemned Iran's missile attack, but also said Israel's incursions into Lebanon violated Lebanon's sovereignty. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres decried what he called, quote, escalation after escalation in the conflict.
Each escalation has served as a pretext for the next. We must never lose sight of the tremendous toll this growing conflict is taking on civilians. And we cannot look away from systematic violations of international humanitarian law. This deadly cycle of tit-for-tat violence must stop. Time is running out, and I thank you.
Israel's foreign minister barred Guterres from entering the country today, accusing him of bias. China's ambassador to the UN said Israel had violated Lebanese sovereignty with its ground incursion. Russia also called on Israel to withdraw its forces. Biden administration officials today defended Israel's ground operations and decried Iran's missile attack as escalatory. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 67 degrees with light rain. In New York City, 65 degrees and overcast. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Good afternoon, this is the Shai Rana Show with your host Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAI-FM.
Winter. Our next guest is the acclaimed New York Times best-selling author, Ta-Nehisi Coates. His new book, The Message, is a trio of interconnected essays that examine how the stories we tell or avoid telling can shape and even distort our reality. In the book, Coates reflects on his emotional first trip to Africa to visit Dakar Senegal. Then he takes readers to Columbia, South Carolina, where he reports on the attempted banning of one of his books on race. And finally, Coates travels to the Middle East to witness the Israeli-Palestinian conflict firsthand. Ta-Nehisi Coates, good morning. How you doing?
Thanks for having me. Good morning, guys.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. You say that this book is written specifically for writers, stating that the task for young writers should be nothing less than changing the world. Why do you feel like writers should bear that responsibility?
Saving the world. Saving the world. Just to be really specific. Writing is how we interpret so much of everything that is around us. The Message is a political book. It argues that much of our politics actually happens before we walk into a voting booth, that our choices around us, that who we believe is human, who we don't believe is human, what policies we believe should be in the world, which policies we don't, are actually shaped largely by writing and the stories we tell. And so I believe that writers, and particularly young writers, have so much to do in the politics and in this time when, you know, obviously we have so much conflict and there's so many quote-unquote issues to be dealt with.
Ta-Nehisi, I want to dive into the Israel-Palestine section of the book. It's the largest section of the book. And I have to say, when I read the book, I imagine if I took your name out of it, took away the awards and the acclaim, took the cover off the book, the publishing house goes away, the content of that section would not be out of place in the backpack of an extremist. And so then I found myself wondering, why does Ta-Nehisi Coates, who I've known for a long time, read his work for a long time, very talented, smart guy, leave out so much? Why leave out that Israel is surrounded by countries that want to eliminate it? Why leave out that Israel deals with terror groups that want to eliminate it? Why not detail anything of the first and the second intifada, the cafe bombings, the bus bombings, the little kids blown to bits? And is it because you just don't believe that Israel, in any condition, has a right to exist?
Well, I would say the perspective that you just outlined, there is no shortage of that perspective in American media. That's the first thing I would say. I am most concerned always with those who don't have a voice, with those who don't have the ability to talk. I have asked repeatedly in my interviews whether there is a single network, mainstream organization in America with a Palestinian American bureau chief or correspondent who actually has a voice to articulate their part of the world. I've been a reporter for 20 years. The reporters of those who believe more sympathetically about Israel and its right to exist don't have a problem getting their voice out. But what I saw in Palestine, what I saw on the West Bank, what I saw in Haifa in Israel, what I saw in the South Hebron Hills, those were the stories that I have not heard. And those were the stories that I was most occupied with. I wrote a 260-page book. It is not a treatise on the entirety of the conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis.
But if you were to read this book, you would be left wondering, why does any of Israel exist? What a horrific place, committing horrific acts on a daily basis. So I think the question is central and key. If Israel has a right to exist, and if your answer is no, then I guess the question becomes, why do the Palestinians have a right to exist? Why do 20 different Muslim countries have a right to exist?
My answer is that no country in this world establishes its ability to exist through rights. Countries establish their ability to exist through force, as America did. And so I think this question of right to Israel does exist. It's a fact. The question of its right is not a question that I would be faced with any other country.
But you write a book that delegitimizes the pillars of Israel. It seems like an effort to topple the whole building of it. So I come back to the question, and it's what I struggled with throughout this book. What is it that so particularly offends you about the existence of a Jewish state that is a Jewish safe place and not any of the other states out there?
There's nothing that offends me about a Jewish state. I am offended by the idea of states built on ethnocracy, no matter where they are.
Muslim included.
I would not want a state where any group of people laid down their citizenship rights based on ethnicity. The country of Israel is a state in which half the population exists on one tier of citizenship, and everybody else that's ruled by Israelis exists on another tier, including Palestinian Israeli citizens. The only people that exist on that first tier are Israeli Jews. Why do we support that? Why is that okay? I'm the child of Jim Crow. I'm the child of people that were born into a country where that was exactly the case of American apartheid. I walk over there and I walk through the occupied territories and I walk down a street in Hebron. And a guy says to me, I can't walk down the street unless I profess my religion. I'm with another pastor. No. I want to. This is very, very important.
It is important. It is
extremely important.
Yeah. Let me lay it down.
I'm working with the person that is guiding me is a Palestinian whose father, whose grandfather and grandmother was born in this town. And I have more freedom to walk than he does. He can't ride on certain roads. He can't get water in the same way that Israeli citizens who live less than a mile away from him can.
And why is that?
Why is that okay?
Why is that? Why is there no agency in this book for the Palestinians? They exist in your narrative merely as victims of the Israelis, as though they were not offered peace at any juncture, as though they don't have a stake in this as well. What is their role in the lack of a Palestinian?
I have a very, 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 very moral compass about this. And again, perhaps it's because of my ancestry. Either apartheid is right or it's wrong. It's really, really simple. Either what I saw was right or it's wrong. I am, for instance, against the death penalty. What the person did to get the death penalty, it really doesn't matter to me. I don't care if they were selling a nickel bag of marijuana or if they were a serial killer. I am against the death penalty. I am against a state that discriminates against people on the basis of ethnicity. I'm against that. There is nothing the Palestinians could do that would make that okay for me. My book is not based on the hyper-morality of the Palestinian people.
In lessons, because many people feel it's complicated. You say it's not complicated. Less than 20 seconds. What's your message?
Less than 20 seconds. I want people to read the book. Well, yeah. And I don't make the assumption that somebody would just read the book and have written and have read nothing else about Israel
okay.
and Palestine.
You're still invited to High Holidays. I'll see you at the show.
Tanahasi,
I mean
so
it,
much. Yeah. That'll do it for us.
Thank you.
Out of time. The message goes on sale tomorrow.
Good afternoon. This is Zain Lamine with the Shai Onana Show, and welcome to World War III, brought to you by a Democratic president by the name of Biden, somebody that's suffering from dementia and is dragging us into a war that will probably last for a while and do damage to the world. And not only that, but if you don't care about what is happening now and what you don't care about, and if you were so focused on voting for the lesser evil, to us, an evil is an evil, to the global South, I mean, an evil is an evil. You should care at least about the fact that the Democratic Party will lose if it drags us into World War III. But anyway, we just listened to two things. One is an opening song by Fairuz, the national singer in Lebanon, who sang about rain falling. And this is a song that was played yesterday as missiles fell on Israel, in the heart of Israel, and on military targets. And people around the Arab world and the global South celebrated this retaliation because for one, the Palestinians were celebrating the fact that those bombs weren't falling on them. And secondly, the Lebanese were celebrating because it took away from the ongoing attempt to genocide the Lebanese people. Including a false information that was given by the Israeli media to U.S. outlets. By the way, the U.S. outlets, the mainstream media like NBC, CBS, CNN, are even worse than the actual Israeli propaganda. But they put out this false information to that the ground war is going to happen, the ground war against Lebanon, and it was an attempt to get the Lebanese resistance to go above ground because they have even a more extensive tunnel system there in Lebanon. But of course, they weren't. They know those tricks. Despite being decapitated, meaning the movement, the head of the Lebanese resistance, as you know, Nasrallah has been killed and assassinated along with 200 innocent Lebanese. and they're calling it an operation instead of a terrorist attack. But anyway, the point is that they put out this false information, and there was some attempt at a ground invasion yesterday, which resulted in the death or in the killing of eight IDF soldiers, which are seen being taken out. So today we're going to have a segment on that, on what happened in terms of the Iranian revolution, Iranian retaliation. What the other segment you heard was Ta-Nehisi quotes the great African American writer, basically tearing apart a white anchor who was a Zionist and an anchor in CBS. While, by the way, two black anchors sat quietly because they're afraid for their career, while this guy spewed his lies, even though this white anchor was an American studies graduate. He represented this false history to Ta-Nehisi, as if Ta-Nehisi hasn't seen it first, as opposed to this anchor. Ta-Nehisi actually visited the occupied territories and saw what he saw, and therefore he was able to demolish his lies, which ended with the white anchor basically inviting him to his house, making like he's his buddy after trying to destroy or undermine what he said in his book about Palestine and what he witnessed, and how similar the situation that he witnessed in the occupied territories reminds him of our Jim Crow, and reminds him of apartheid in South Africa. Another thing I wanted to talk about is the fact that we did have several things happening, including a pager attack, obviously, that was painted as a sophisticated operation, which actually was the detonation of thousands of pagers that had been distributed among the general population. And these were detonated during the day when these pagers were out among other in other public places. And Atlantic magazine called it a sophisticated operation. Imagine if 1,000 suicide bombers had gone off in Israel, what Atlantic magazine would have called it. And also, I want to remind you that many of these pagers were also distributed among health workers and doctors. And even after the explosion, some Lebanese doctors refused to give up their pagers and take certain precautions, because that was their only connection to their patients and to the hospital. And that's what was called as a sophisticated operation. This is how the mainstream media sees us as subhuman, and therefore there could never be any terrorist attack against Arabs, right? There could never be a genocide against Arabs. And that's what our representatives, the vast majority, you know, 99% of our representatives are racists, are anti-Arab, are anti-Palestinian. And we are Semitic people, and nobody ever says that's anti-Semitism. It's remarkable. But comeuppance is coming. We'll see about that. Anyway, the other thing I wanted to talk about is this upcoming clip that we're gonna play. And that's a clip that was done It was an interview that was done by Judge Napolitano, who's been doing great stuff. And this was one of his most popular segments in the past week. There's so much I wanted to share with you in terms of the analysis of what happened in the past 2 days, yesterday, that I can't share, but at least I can share this half hour's interview with Scott Ritter, who was the UN inspector back during the Iraq War. And for those of you who are anti-war and peace activists, remember that it was Scott Ritter that exposed the lie that we don't have weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. There are no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And of course, he was proven to be right. And so he talks, I found this to be a comprehensive and concise analysis of what happened. So let's have a listen to Scott Ritter talking about his analysis of what happened yesterday.
Hi, everyone. Judge Andrew Napolitano here for Judging Freedom. Today is Tuesday, October. What is today? Long day. October 1st, 2024. Scott Ritter joins us now. Scott, I very much appreciate you coming on the last minute. It's been a long day for both of us and for all the folks watching us. What do we know about the Iranian missile attack today on Israel? What did it consist of? What was struck down? What got through? What damage, if any, did it do?
Well, I can't say we know anything other than the Iranians fired a significant number of missiles, the majority of which appeared to strike the ground. Whether or not they struck the ground where they intended to strike is unknowable until the Iranians tell us what their objectives were and what their battle damage assessment. I would imagine that if these missiles did strike their intended targets, Israel will not, not be quick to confirm that, because the last thing you want to do when you're on the receiving end of missiles is confirm the accuracy of the missiles. Iran doesn't have a sophisticated, space-based reconnaissance capability to take immediate battle damage assessment. So even the Iranians will be, guessing to some extent. It appears, however, that a significant number of missiles were targeted at Nevatim Air Base outside of Beersheba. This is one of Israel's most important air bases. It's where the F-35 fighters are based out of, along with Netanyahu's Air Force One and some other, critical air assets. The videotape of this attack shows what appear to be hypersonic missiles, coming in significant quantity and hitting what they're, hitting something on the ground. Some of them may have been intercepted, but not all of them. This appears to be part of the Iranian strategy of saturation attacks. If you take a look at the quantity of the missiles being fired, it simply overwhelmed Israel's air defense systems. The Iranians also appear to have made use of the more sophisticated missiles, the hypersonic Fatah 2. They fired to take out the Arrow 2 and Arrow 3 surface-to-air missile or anti-missile defense shields. I've been looking at some videos that look as though the Iranians were deploying sophisticated warheads that have multiple warheads and decoys and accelerating warheads. So they used a variety of means. You know, back in April when we talked about this, you know, I said, look, the Iranians let off with old stuff. It was just basically exhaust the Israelis, exhaust the air defense, and then they finished with, a dozen or so of the good stuff, and all of those hit their target. And at the time, I said this was Iran putting a marker on the table, saying the next time you're just going to get the good stuff. Well, this was the next time Israel got the good stuff, and what we saw here is that Israel is defenseless, utterly. You may shoot down, 10% of the incoming missiles. But the bottom line is Iran saturated Israel's missile defense shield. And it wasn't just Israel's. Israel had the assistance of the United States, the United States Navy, and American THAAD systems. The Jordanians were actively involved, bragging about how they shot down one or two missiles. So you basically had the world's densest, most sophisticated ballistic missile shield being exposed as utterly useless. And this is a signal in and of itself to the Israelis, because they are talking about retaliation. And if Israel retaliates in a significant way, Iran has already reloaded all 180 plus launchers that were involved in the first one. They have others in reserve. Remember, right now, Iran is also holding a loaded pistol against the head of the United States, letting the United States know that if they get involved in any offensive action against Israel, Al-Udeid Air Base in Qatar will be destroyed just like Nevatim was. There's no defense against it. Al-Assad Air Base in Iraq will be destroyed just like Nevatim was. There's no defense against it. And Iran may strike, the American naval base in Bahrain, the home of the Fifth Fleet. This was a tremendous display of capability by Iran, one that Israel and the United States would do well to reflect on before undertaking any precipitous moves.
Are the hypersonic missiles the ones that are impossible to stop?
Well, I wouldn't say impossible, because technology being what it is, you always might be able to find a solution. I would imagine that if you fired one hypersonic against a defensive capability that was ready to receive it, you might get lucky. But generally speaking, the hypersonics are coming in at a rate of engagement, a rate of closure, that's too fast for any radar system today to configure an intercept solution and have the interceptor actually be able to do it. I think what we saw was there were some occasions of the Israelis playing catch up, meaning that they were trying to catch up to the warhead, but they couldn't. It was going too fast. And it appears that the hypersonics that Iran fired just came through. The Israeli air sirens didn't even go off, so they didn't even detect it. That's how fast they were going. That's how quick their closure speed was.
Do the Israelis have hypersonics?
No. The Israelis have the Jericho 2 and the Jericho 3 missile. These are nuclear capable, but they can fire a conventional payload. And the Jericho 3 is believed to have something that that will have closure speeds similar to a hypersonic missile. But it's a ballistic missile, which means that its speed is generated by a ballistic trajectory. A hypersonic is a missile that comes in on a non-ballistic trajectory and usually under its own power. And hits the ground at significant speeds that aren't generated by a ballistic trajectory.
Is the Israeli Iron Dome, about which they've been boasting for generations, effectively useless?
Well, the Iron Dome wasn't meant to defend against these systems. The Iron Dome was meant to defend against a saturation attack by Katyushka rockets or low technology, short range rockets. It wasn't designed to defend against the saturation attack of ballistic missiles or ballistic missiles. This is what the Arrow 2, the Arrow 3, the Patriot.